We love to mess with the English language. Sometimes we turn nouns into verbs, we invent new words, or we just change the meaning of an existing word. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Patricia O'Connor. She's a language expert and the author of Origins of the Specious, as well as many other books. Today we will explore our ever-evolving English language. It is also the second day of our very short 3-day membership drive here at Iowa Public Radio. Please take a moment today to invest in the public radio service that you depend on for in-depth news and analysis, for unbiased news delivered without hype and without spin, and for great conversation. Your dollars make it possible. Call 800-897-9204 or go online at iowapublicradio.org. The news is next. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're going to dialogue about the evolution of the English language. We may verb some nouns. We may even make up some new words. My guest today is Patricia O'Connor. She is a language expert and the proprietor of Grammarphobia.com. She's also the author of, among other books, Origins of the Specious, which recently came out in paperback. We'd love to hear some examples of how you've noticed the English language has changed, maybe some of the things that drive you crazy, or maybe some of the new usages that you really love. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Hello, Pat.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for having me.
You know, a lot of language purists get really upset when the language changes. You know as much about the English language as anyone. How do you feel when it evolves?
Well, in some cases, I think it's a welcome change. In other cases, I think it's not so welcome, as when impact becomes a verb and dialogue and interface become verbs. But what seems to happen is if a word works, if it seems right for the case, and if enough people use it, it makes its way into the language, whether we like it or not. But as you might expect, most of my mail and most of the stuff that goes on in my blog is about people who are upset about one thing or another. And so I usually poke into the history of a usage and find out that it didn't always mean what you think. For example, just in the last couple of days, I answered a question from somebody who was upset about the use of the word iconic to mean something important or something symbolic or somehow representative of something else. And he says, this thing they're talking about, iconic, it has no religious meaning, so they're misusing it. Well, in fact, iconic didn't start out with any religious meaning. An icon originally was just a portrait or an image, a representation of something. It didn't acquire its religious significance until the 19th century. And now it's metaphorically being used to mean something significant or representative, and so it's taken on another meaning that happens to be secular. So in a way, the word is returning to its old secular roots that it had back in Greek. And it just meant an image.
Well, clearly the language has changed a lot over the decades and the centuries. We're not all still speaking like Shakespeare.
Sure.
But there does seem to be this feeling among many people that whatever they learned at their impressionable age was correct, has to be correct forever.
True. And people have always thought that. Even back in the days of Old English, people were wringing their hands and saying that the language is going down the tubes because of various misusages. For instance, in Chaucer's day, the word girl meant a child of either sex. It didn't evolve so it just meant a female child until later, and the word boy came into being. Another word that has completely done a 180-degree turn is cute. Now, back in the days when it was short for acute, it meant shrewd or perceptive or sharp or calculating, that sort of thing. Although, believe it or not, at one time it was actually used to mean bow-legged. But
belegged?
Bow-legged.
Oh, bow-legged.
bow-legged. But cute in the sense in which we use it today was considered vulgar slang in the 19th century. And young people got chewed out for using it, for saying, oh, that's cute, in response to a comment or something. That was considered vulgar slang, much the way people might get chewed out by Aunt Millie for using the word cred or bling today or some sort of street talk. But you get the drift. When words are in the process of evolving, which has been happening since the very beginning, people think, oh, it's the end of the world. We're losing the language. It's out of control. It's not actually out of control. But as I said before, I don't always like some of these new usages.
Well, and I think there are people in England who listen to American English and think that it got out of control a very
exactly.
long time ago.
Exactly. Actually, they changed the language much more than we did. I've talked about this on Talk of Iowa before, so I won't go into it too much, but what we think of as the British accent was mainly formed in the 19th century after the colonies broke off from England, and a lot of the differences between American English and British English were British inspired. For instance, they used to use apartment instead of flat. They used to now I can't, my mind is empty, but they used to say autumn and fall, and we've preserved both words, but they preserved merely autumn. So now a lot of British speakers think of fall as an Americanism, but actually it's an old English word. But back to changing language, there are so many ways in which a living language changes, and this isn't just English. But one of the principal ways is called conversion, and this is when a word that has one function, say it's a noun, becomes used as a verb. And this is what annoys a lot of people. This is where we get impact and dialogue and interface. But we've gotten a lot of other words this way, too. Would you believe that the verb cook, as in to cook dinner, began life as a noun? We didn't always have a verb cook. We formed the verb from the noun. By the same process, we acquired verbs like hammer, and a lot of other verbs that have to do with tools. We had the word for the tool first, and later we formed it into a verb. This is how the verb farm got formed. We had the noun farm first, and the verb farm came later. So all these verbs were adaptations of earlier nouns. And in the same way, verbs get nouned. Sometimes we have a verb, say, run, and it gets formed into a noun, as in a winning run. This is how we got the noun walk, as in a long walk, or worry, as in this is a serious worry, or a call, a vicious attack. All those nouns were first verbs. And somewhere along the line, somebody got the idea of using those as nouns. Take a call. Phone me, those sort of things. And so that's how we acquired new words. And it happens with adjectives, too. An adjective like yellow or slow becomes a verb when somebody says, the paper has yellowed, or this process has slowed, or it's beginning to slow. In all these cases, this is an expansion of the language because we've started to use a word for a different function.
Those all sound so benign, though, compared to dialogue, which is so obnoxious. So maybe the rule is we shouldn't be able to turn nouns into verbs if they're going to be used in mission statements.
That's a good one. And I think one thing that's annoying is that when bureaucrats do it, it's so ungraceful. It's so inelegant.
And calculated.
Yes. They seem to have a talent for forming annoying words, gobbledygook, bureaucratic words. When everyday people do it, it seems more reasonable. But when the bureaucrats do it, it's annoying, because often it's because they're shoving something down our throats at the same time. We've got to dialogue.
Right. Well, and I remember the...
Please interface with so-and-so before you go any further. See, usages like that make you growl to yourself. You say, I hate that word dialogue. I hate that word interface, because it's been used to you by an obnoxious person.
Right. Or even the, I remember in the 90s, there was the, I think it was a Microsoft commercial, the new way to office.
Oh, my gosh.
And that just drove me
insane. I haven't heard that before. Advertisers,
yeah.
They can be very obnoxious. The people of Vanguard, for instance, have started to use Vanguard as a verb. They're trying to market this. Have you vanguarded lately? Learn to Vanguard. They're trying to slip this into our vocabulary. I don't think it's going to work.
We'll see. Bob is on the line from Mallard. Hello, Bob.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
I just was wondering about, it seems like you're welcome as a response to thank you is being replaced by thank you. And I just, I'll get off the phone and listen to the comment on the radio.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Bob is saying that when people say thank you, instead of saying you're welcome, they say thank you.
Right.
I understand it. That's the, yeah. Right. Believe it or not, I've gotten a lot of mail about this, and I've even discussed it a couple of times on my blog at grammarphobia.com. I'm not sure why this is so annoying to people, but I think part of the issue might be that when someone says thank you, if you say you're welcome, you're acknowledging that there was a debt paid. But if you say thank you, it sort of turns it around, saying, no, I'm the one who should be thanking you. There's an element of modesty involved. I think that's why people are saying that so often.
Well, and I hear it a lot on the radio, and I've heard
sure
people complain about it. But
you
but,
thank a guest.
Right, and they say thank
saying,
you.
You're welcome, the guest says thank you. And I think the reason is the guest is saying, well, yes, indeed, I was doing you a favor by being on your show, so therefore I'll say you're welcome. And it's a little more modest to say thank you.
Right. Thank you for the opportunity.
Right. Right.
Well, it is interesting because I've gotten letters from listeners complaining about that, too. I wonder if it's something that we hear more often in media, on television and on the radio, than
that,
we
that
do
may
in
be
normal
true.
Conversation.
That may be true. When I'm on the radio now, I try to say thank you for inviting me. that seems to make a little more sense to people than saying thank you. But I'd feel odd saying you're welcome. It sounds as though, the obligation was on my part to be on the show, and you owe me. <or something. laughs> I don't know what it is. It's a psychological thing. A lot of times the language develops this way.
Right. Well, I have something else that I've heard on the radio, and please feel free to call in with your pet peeves, the things that you've heard change that you don't like, or maybe something that has changed that you do like using. Let us know. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us. There's another one. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And there's one that I've heard a lot in reporting recently, and that is people used to say meanwhile or in the meantime, and now they just say meantime.
Mm.
Have you heard that change?
I haven't, but I think they're thinking of it, they're equating it exactly with meanwhile.
Well,
because meanwhile doesn't need anything else.
Right, and that drives me crazy, because it certainly seems like meantime does need something else, but
yeah,
does it?
But etymologically, it really doesn't, because time, while is etymologically connected with time. That was its original meaning. For a while means for a time. So meantime is in a sense parallel to meanwhile. It's just that we usually see it or hear it in the phrase "in the meantime," and we think that's the only way it should be used.
Right.
But
these people are just out ahead of me, I guess.
Yes.
Deborah's on the line from Fairfield. We just have a moment, Deborah. What would you like to talk about?
Oh, I was just going to comment. Thank you on your thank you and you're welcome. I'm a chiropractor and I work in Amish homes for many years now, and so I'm so sweetly aware of their sweetness, and also this phenomenon that you're describing of saying thank you or you're welcome, and I've kind of thrown it around in my head for some time now, and I decided to say thank you and you're welcome, or you're welcome and thank you, actually, I should say, because I am providing a service and they're thanking me for that, so I feel obligated to say you're welcome, and yet I'm grateful for them, for them paying me for their kind and gentle ways and so many things. So that's how I've solved the problem in my own heart and mind.
You're covering all the bases.
And thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Deborah, thank you so much for your call. And we will talk more about our ever-evolving English language in just a few minutes. We do need to take a break. My guest today is Patricia O'Connor, language expert and author of Origins of the Specious.
You say either, I say either, you say neither, and I say neither.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Neither, neither, let's call the whole thing off.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today my guest is Patricia O'Connor. She's a language expert. Her website is grammarphobia.com, and she's also the author of, among other books, Origins of the Specious, which just came out in paperback. And today we're talking about the evolution of the English language, and although we all speak an evolved English language, a lot of us have a lot of trouble with some of the recent changes to the language. And of course, we'd love to hear about your pet peeves. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Marilyn is on the line in Perry. Hello, Marilyn.
Hi.
Hi.
The word usage that has made me cringe recently is using calendar as a verb. Let's calendar.
Oh, why?
And I'm thinking, yeah, I've heard it a couple times, and I'm thinking, why not use schedule? And then I think, well, schedule is both a noun and a verb.
Mm-hmm.
Did it start out as one and become the other?
I'm sure it did. I don't know which came first, but these things never evolve smack at the same time. One exists, and then someone thinks, well, we need a verb for this thing, so we'll use it as a verb, too, or vice versa. Are you a cook? Do you cook?
Do I cook? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are nouns for food items, you may have noticed, like peel and pit, as in orange peel, cherry pit. Mm-hmm. Those nouns for those things, and there are many others, seed, for example. They also became verbs for the removal of same. For instance, you say, peel this orange, pit these cherries, seed this tomato. So that's how words come into the language, because they exist in one form, and then we need the other form. We need the other shoe to drop, so we invent the other word. Mm-hmm. But this works not just for functions of words, but also for, they change in their number too. For instance, words like agenda, trivia, insignia, stamina even, those all used to be plural words in the 19th century, and they started being used as singulars, and at first people were bothered by this, but now we accept that agenda is a singular item. It's not things on a list, it's the list itself. Now this is happening with media and data, and people are all upset about it again, which is, it's predictable, but this is the way words change.
But who is using calendar? Is there just one person in your life that's using that, or have you heard more people?
I heard it nearly 20 years ago. at a professional meeting, and then I heard it just recently used, you know, as just two individuals were scheduling some time together, calendaring some time together.
Huh.
Well, I don't think it's caught on yet, but I guess I guess we may start hearing more of it.
I hope not.
Nothing surprises me.
Marilyn, thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
Oh, can I mention one story?
Sure.
This is an Iowa angle. Some friends visited us from Iowa City last week. I come from Iowa, I think I may have told you.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had Iowa City visitors out here, and we live in Connecticut. And they, on the way, they stopped at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. And while they were there, they saw a tree that was labeled, and this is its real name, Caucasian Wingnut. This is a real tree. It's in the walnut family. And they were so tickled, they told us about it when they got here. And it turns out this tree is called Caucasian because it comes from the Caucasus. And it's called wingnut because of its seeds. It's little nutlets that have wings on either side.
But...
And that started me thinking about the term wingnut and how it came to mean a wacko.
Yeah.
And it actually showed up, as you might imagine, in hardware stores. In the early 20th century, it meant a nut, the kind you find in a hardware store, with wing-like projections on either side so you can tighten it with your fingers without having to use tools. And only in the 80s did it come to mean an eccentric or a fool or a wacko. It came to mean a political wacko only very recently. But see, this is another example of the evolution of language, and I thought I'd put it on my blog tomorrow because I thought it was so interesting.
It is interesting. Maybe we have more political wackos, so we had a need for the word.
Yes, I mean, maybe the Caucasian wingnut will be entered in the New York gubernatorial race.
We will see. Oh, David is on the line in Cedar Falls. Hello, David.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Very good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I agree with Ms. O'Connor that there's a lot of, like, verbs becoming nouns or nouns becoming verbs. I don't like some of them, but I'm trying to work with accepting them. But there's another category of language change I'd like her opinion on. It's where I, at least it seems different to me, where things are just factually wrong. An example of this is what's happened to the phrase to beg the question.
Oh, yes.
Which, has a, as we know, has a particular, it refers to a logical error, but has become, people are using it, I hear it on NPR even, to replace the phrase, to raise the question.
Right, but right.
The other example, and I'll get off and listen what you have to say, is where people will say, I hear this on NPR too, none of them are.
Oh, well, yeah,
well,
I'll have something to say about
that. Wrong. And so I just wanted to know what she thought about things like that and whether they're different to her than the kind of thing where a verb becomes a noun or vice versa.
All right, David, thank you so much for your call. Let's start with beg the question.
Oh, okay.
And tell us a little bit about the origin of that, because it is something that is in common usage, and if you don't know the origin, you wouldn't think it's wrong.
Right. It's a philosophical term. It was actually invented by Aristotle, not in English, of course, but in the Greek form. And he meant something different by beg. And in fact, it's too bad that it was translated by the word beg into English, because what he meant was to present the question as a fact. In other words, when you beg the question, I'll give you an example of begging the question. Let's see. My son did not commit this crime because he is not a criminal. It's sort of a circular argument, where in the definition of the word criminal or crime, you're using that definition to show that a hypothesis can't be true. I'm not doing a very good job of explaining this, but
I think I understand
that.
And
it's more like when you start out your argument by presenting what is yet to be proven as a given fact.
So
that's begging the question. But that's a very complicated concept for people to get, for people to hold in their minds. Even for me, and I was a philosophy major in college, People now use beg the question to mean raise the question, to present another question, to change the question. They use it in a variety of ways that if you consider that original meaning the only correct one would have to be incorrect. But again, this is another way in which language changes. Misusages become accepted.
Well, and it does seem to logically make sense that if you say something begs the question, it invites the question. That's
Yes, and that's one way misusages start. It's something, it seems logically to mean one thing, and it actually means another. So it makes sense that people would come to misunderstand it and misuse it. But that's one way language changes, misusage. Now, he mentioned the word none.
Right.
It's not true that none means not one. Etymologically, it's closer to not any.
So none of them are would be correct.
None of them are would be correct.
Okay.
This is something else I've discussed at length on my blog. If David would care to look it up, but I'll just briefly say that none can be either singular or plural. It depends on whether it refers to a singular subject or a plural subject. If you say none of them, you want a plural verb. If you say none of it, you want a singular verb. None of the milk was spilled. None of the cookies were eaten. So it's not true that none always means not one. Okay. Think of it as meaning not any. Not any of it or not any of them.
Even though I think we can throw David a bone and say that subject-verb agreement is something that a lot of people need to work on.
Yeah, that will never, I don't think that will ever change. That's part of the grammatical underpinnings of the language, and I don't think that will ever change. Also, pronoun case. For instance, he, she, it will always be singulars. And they will always take singular verbs, they, them, their, plural verbs. There are things that are probably immutable laws of language. But keep in mind that people look to Latin a lot of times to make their arguments. When Latin was a living language, when people were born speaking Latin or born into Latin-speaking homes, it was a living language just like English, and it changed. A lot of Latin nouns came from Latin verbs and vice versa. They have derivatives that were formed from earlier types of words, just as we do. It grew and changed, and there were arguments over pronunciations, meanings, and that sort of thing in Cicero's day. So don't always think that English is imperfect because it's changing and the Latin was perfect and never changed. Not so.
Along the lines of David's first pet peeve, though, the beg the question, we got a tweet from someone who says their pet peeve is people who get common idioms senselessly wrong, like by in large instead of by and large.
Yeah.
And that does happen
a
lot.
One. Or people will say they were racing neck in neck. Well, it's not neck in neck. It's neck and neck.
There's another one that I've heard, instead of saying for all intents and purposes, I've heard all intensive purposes.
That's a common one. Also, a tough road to hoe instead of tough row to hoe, as if you could hoe a road.
Right.
That's another way that language changes, although I think that those... people get corrected on common idioms so much that I think that it's never going to become tough road to hoe, I hope.
Greg is on the line in Ames. Hello, Greg.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for this great topic. Here's one of my pet peeves. I don't quite know how to describe this, so I'll give you an example. It would be the dropping of the to be in something. And I've actually seen this in print now in the Des Moines Register. And it's, say, painting. Let's use that to paint something. You would say, that needs to be painted, or that needs painting.
Uh-huh.
But what I hear a lot is that needs painted.
Uh-huh. Right.
And it just grates on me.
Right. I get a lot of complaints about that one, too, believe it or not. It's the verb need is, it's a very complicated word, and it goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. But one of the, it could mean a lack of something. It could mean something that has to be done. But a common way to use needs is needs painting. It's used with a participle. It also is used with the infinitive and a past participle, needs to be painted. Those have been around for a long time. This thing needs painted. This is a relatively newish thing, only been around for about a century or so, and it seems to be regional.
I was just going to ask that, because I've certainly noticed it in different places.
Right. It's common in the South, and it's common in the Midwest. I don't have my regional dictionary with me right now, but I think it's the South and the Midwest needs painted. Or the car needs washed. That's a common one. Instead of the car needs washing or the car needs to be washed, it's conflated to the car needs washed.
So if that's a part of our regional dialect,
right,
does that mean that it's okay to use that, or is it...
Well, see, I don't think... This is my opinion. I don't think regionalisms are incorrect. I don't think we should talk about correctness or incorrectness. If it's customary in a particular region to say the car needs washed, then I don't see how you can call it incorrect. Someone grows up hearing that. We adopt language from what we hear around us. Granted, we hear a lot of incorrect things. But if everyone in a region is saying the car needs washed, there's something going on that's more important than matters of correctness or incorrectness. It's a customary usage in that region. So I think we should think of it that way rather than that it's incorrect.
I'm sure it's still going to drive you crazy, Greg, but thank you so much for your call. Next up, we have Margo in Monroe, Wisconsin. Hello, Margo. Hi, Margo. Are you there? We seem to have lost Margo.
She probably thought the car needed wash. Right. She went to the car wash.
Maybe. Tom is on the line in Fort Dodge. Hello, Tom.
Hi. Something that really drives me nuts is hearing people use the phrase "could care less" when they really mean "could not care less."
Right, right.
And when you're speaking of the use of nouns as verbs, you know, don't when you hear "don't disrespect me,"
mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Well, I hate to break this to you, but disrespect was a verb hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Oh, it was.
Yeah,
okay.
And it fell out of use, and it has recently come back into usage. It used to be a very common verb, to
okay.
disrespect. So we shouldn't jump to conclusions sometimes when we hear something and we think it's incorrect. It may be a revival. Old usage that had disappeared for a long time.
I've noticed that the last few years, it's really gotten to be popular, much like the use of "per se" to mean so to speak. When they really mean to say "so to speak," they use the term "per se." It's crazy.
Right, right. But as for "could care less," I think there's an irony to that phrase that we shouldn't overlook. We all know that the proper phrase is "couldn't care less," and I think people who use "could care less" know that. I think that the reason they say "could care less" is it's ironic, and it means something like, as if this was important enough to be last on my list, as if this is so important that it's the thing I care about, or as if this was important enough to be at the bottom of the list. Do you see what I mean? there are things that I care even less about. It's mediocre.
Yes, I don't know as I share this.
You don't have to agree with me or share it.
No, I understand that.
But I think that there's also a sometimes when you deliver a phrase, the sound of it, the nuances, the rhythms, and the melody of it have something to do with your meaning. And when you say "I couldn't care less," you say it that way. I couldn't. You put the accent on couldn't. I couldn't care less. Now, when people say "I could care less," it's different. They put the accent on care. I could care less.
I have to side with Tom a little bit, though, in that I think that a lot of people who say "I could care less" are not thinking about it in terms of irony.
No, it's just
a reflex.
I understand that, but I think that in its genesis, it had that meaning.
Okay. We had another tweet. This is from Chris, and it's one of my pet peeves, too. The intentional misuse of literally, literally, makes me wince, he said. what are your thoughts about that?
Me, too. I agree. I agree with her. Although I have to state the case of those who disagree and think there are people who think that literally sometimes is used as an intensifier to mean intensely figurative. Now I don't buy that argument. I think it's just a misuse.
Yes.
But again, the caller earlier was a David who said, "Isn't there a category of words that they evolve through misusage?" And I think this is one of those.
Right.
I don't use literally that way. I literally fell off my stool to mean an intensifier of figuratively. I don't quite buy that. It still sounds like a misuse to me, and I don't use it. But I think it may be evolving that way.
We may have to learn to live with it.
Yeah.
Tracy sent us an email from Davenport, and she says, "A fairly recent trend of acronyms being regularly substituted for actual words is concerning to me. My 14-year-old niece can't spell but can carry on a conversation with her friends via text, instant message, etc. Mm-hmm. I shudder to think about how laws will be written when her generation is running the country."
Well, I think that when her generation is running the country, it'll still be young lawyers writing the laws, and then they do have to go to law school after all. So I think probably that will get beaten out of them, I hope.
We will see about that.
Yeah, I would hate to see ASAP in a law.
Right.
It's too vague.
Or LOL.
Right.
Linda's on the line in Waverly. Hello, Linda.
Hello. I have a couple. I'm going to change one of mine because I want to comment on something your speaker said. That I don't enjoy it when people will say voila instead of voila. It's a French word, and it begins with a V, and you'll hear it in commercials, and you'll hear supposedly intelligent people changing it because they don't understand that, you know, the way it's supposed to be pronounced.
Right.
But the thing that I wanted to comment on with this regional use,
one of the
things that I think it is wrong, and I think that people should change or point those things out to people, because a lot of times it's simply ignorance. When I moved to Iowa and married, I noticed that people here say them books and them houses and them cars. Mm-hmm. And I used to comment on it all the time. And my ex-husband said, well, that's the way my teacher said it. You know, that's just, I've always thought it was right. Well, it's not right.
Oh,
it's,
you know,
Linda, we're running out of time.
I can't believe his teacher said that.
Yeah.
But let me say one thing. Saying them books, that was one of the things I commented on earlier. The case of pronouns, them is always going to be plural. And it's not a regionalism. I wouldn't call that a regionalism because it's just a mistake. It's bad grammar. And wherever bad grammar exists, I think it's going to be just bad grammar. It's not regional. People who, there are probably people who get that wrong in every state of the country. So regionalism is not an excuse for bad grammar, for saying them books.
Pat, thank you so much for your time today, and we have run out of time, but thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Patricia O'Connor is a language expert. She's the proprietor of GrammarPhobia.com and the author of, among other books, Origins of the Species. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
You're just too marvelous.